It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert will be back on Monday. Coming up in a few moments, a look at billionaires in the United States and around the world and the influence they have on politics, the economy, and more. First, school gardens are getting more and more popular across the state. One high school in southwest Wisconsin is taking its school garden to the next level and raising chickens. Maureen McCollum has more on this one-of-a-kind project.
Just inside a room in Holman High School, 150 fuzzy, yellow, week-old chicks huddle together under heat lamps. Every morning, Gregory O'Loughlin checks on them. The high school junior first makes sure their bedding is clean and dry.
And then usually take the water out, fill it, and then as it's filling, feed them. And then feed them all at the same time so they're not fighting over everything.
These chicks will stay at the high school until they get bigger. From there, they'll move to nearby farms where students and volunteers will continue to care for them. After 8 weeks, the chickens head to a Minnesota processing facility. Eventually, the chicken will return to Holman, where it'll be served in the cafeteria. O'Loughlin has helped raise hundreds of other chickens for the school. Those have already been sent to the processing facility.
The batch that's up there in Utica, that's the batch that I raised over the summer. And it's just good to know that I'm helping, like, the school, like, feed the schools.
Senior Chris Jessen got the idea to raise poultry as part of a Future Farmers of America, or FFA, project. It initially had a career development focus, but then Jessen thought he could work poultry into the farm-to-school program. His fellow FFA members can learn more about chickens while teaching their classmates about what it takes to raise food.
Most kids just don't really know the background of their food. They just, oh, it just popped up on my plate and that's about it. They don't take the time to appreciate the time that farmers put into it, or students such as Greg, and that just really did a lot, took time out of their day to do this.
Not only are Holman students raising chickens, but they also grow lettuce year-round in a hydroponic garden that goes straight to the high school cafeteria's salad bar. Students raise sweet corn and potatoes that are served throughout the district, and each school has an outdoor garden lush with tomatoes, peppers, and squash. These are just some of the 200-plus school gardens in Wisconsin. Wisconsin School Garden Initiative training and outreach specialist Beth Hanna says more and more schools are starting gardens each year. She says that's great because school gardens encourage students to eat healthier.
Whether it's that student who planted the seed, or it's then in the cafeteria where students are more likely to try it because they know where it came from. They know their class grew it, or they know of the high schooler down the road who helped.
For Holman AgriScience instructor and FFA advisor Roger King, it's also about teaching future farmers about what consumers want. He says more people want to know where their food comes from, and that mindset can shape his curriculum.
I think as a society, the value of food and the value of good nutrition is, we've charged that probably not openly to American agriculture, but American agriculture knows that we have to do that. And because if not, we're not going to support the society we have. And I think that's, to me, an intriguing part of getting involved in agriculture and FFA.
In a few months, the chicken will return to Holman frozen. The district is going to pick one day when all the students in every school will have it for lunch. The FFA students will serve the chicken to their classmates, remaining involved with the poultry from start to finish. Before that, they just have to settle on the perfect baked chicken recipe. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Are you a billionaire? Odds are you're not. They're few and far between. According to Forbes, there's, you know, a little north of 1,600 of them on the whole planet. But their names come up a lot in the world of politics, where a billionaire's support can put a candidate or a cause on the map. It's led to controversy in the U.S. and elsewhere over how much influence is too much. Our next guest tackles that controversy in his new book. Darrell West is Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. His new book is Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. Darrell, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Nice to be with you.
So how much more influence do billionaires have on American politics than everybody else?
They have a lot of influence. Of course, the concentration of wealth is much greater now than it has been in a number of decades. We basically have the same level of income concentration dating back to the 1920s. But also, the laws on political activity are much looser now, in part because of all the Supreme Court decisions. And so the thing that I worry about is that our politics has returned to a pre-Watergate era of great secrecy and big money, and that's always a toxic combination for democracies.
Well, how much more access does a billionaire have to, say, a high-level policymaker than anyone else?
They have a great deal of access because it used to be under the old campaign finance rules that there were limits on how much politicians could contribute to candidates. But now in the world of super PACs, you have individuals who are spending $100,000 or above. In the 2012 election, we had some billionaires who spent ten or hundreds of millions of dollars on that campaign. And so obviously politicians pay attention to that, and it gives those wealthy individuals unusual access to our government officials.
And you mentioned the get a senator policy. How does that play out?
Well, this is something a wealthy individual, I was talking with him, and he's the one who described this strategy for me. You know, we're all familiar with congressional gridlock and the fact that, you know, it's hard to get anything done. And he said that there are some individuals who basically they try and find a sympathetic senator, and when an appointment comes that they don't like, they can convince that senator to place a secret hold on that nomination so that it can't be considered by the Senate. We are, of course, familiar with individual senators who filibuster legislation. And the New York Times actually had an interesting example of this. Bill Ackman is a Wall Street financier, was very upset with his company, Herbalife. He questioned the business model of this company. He was able to get Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts to write letters to the Securities and Exchange Commission demanding an investigation of this company and also to the Federal Trade Commission. So, you know, there's evidence that people actually are engaging in this type of strategy.
So they have some outsized influence in terms of access. They can spend money on election, but there aren't many billionaires. They only get to vote once, just like everybody else. Aren't there countervailing forces out there, advocacy groups and the like, that can kind of balance out their influence?
Absolutely. And we saw that in the 2012 presidential election because there are all these wealthy individuals who tried to defeat Obama, and obviously they lost. But these are smart business people. What those individuals have done is to go back and analyze their own failure. They have dissected their 2012 strategy, and they've come back this year with a retooled message. In 2012, they had kind of dry analytical criticisms about big government and high debt levels. This year, they're basically in their ads, they're putting ordinary people around the kitchen table and having them talk about Obamacare and why they think Obamacare is bad for them and they can't see the doctor that they want to see and their costs are rising. And so there's a possibility that these individuals can be much more successful in 2014 than they were in 2012.
So those are conservative billionaires. Aren't there liberal billionaires involved in politics? Do they balance each other out?
There certainly are liberal billionaires. We see the example of Michael Bloomberg, who's been very active in fighting gun violence. This year, he's pledged $50 million to take on the NRA and to try and elect people who are sympathetic to his cause. He's also been very active on promoting immigration reform. Tom Steyer is a billionaire who's probably less well-known than many of these other individuals. He has pledged $100 million in this year's elections to try and elevate public awareness about climate change. And then, of course, George Soros has been active in building grassroots networks for a number of years. So there certainly are some billionaires who are more liberal and who support Democratic causes.
When it comes to the range of opinions on various topics, though, are billionaires, do they represent the same range of opinions as everyone else? They just have more money? Or are there issues that they look at really differently than the population as a whole?
I mean, if they were perfectly representative in terms of public opinion, we wouldn't be having this conversation and people wouldn't be worried about them. But in fact, there has been research that compares the views of really rich people with the general public and finds that wealthy individuals tend to be more conservative. They're less willing to support investments in education and healthcare. They are much more likely to support tax cuts. And So you can see why this creates problems for our political system.
And you say that even the more liberal billionaires on that last issue you mentioned, tax cuts, they may be more in line with their conservative peers.
Definitely. I mean, even liberal billionaires actually don't like to pay higher taxes. Probably no big surprise there. And in 2012, this is actually a problem for President Obama because there are all these conservative billionaires who are spending a lot on behalf of Republicans. But the liberal billionaires did not like Obama's rhetoric on raising taxes on the wealthy people. And so they either sat on their hands or they made a relatively small contribution to the campaign. And so, you know, that created real issues. So on that issue, we often see kind of liberal and conservative billionaires sticking out the same type of position.
So you say outsized influence for billionaires, different opinions than the population as a whole. Does this translate into billionaires make government less representative?
Well, they certainly have become very adept at pushing their own particular viewpoints. Now, at the state level, we see a wide range of issue advocacy on the part of billionaires. We have billionaires who have put a lot of money into same-sex marriage, legalizing marijuana, fighting gun violence, reforming pensions. A lot of billionaires have actually migrated to the state level because, you know, a number of states have the referendum process, and so you can put issues directly on the ballot, and, you know, if you can persuade voters to go for it, that produces public policy right there. They also realize that the state level is advantageous because news organizations are much weaker at the state level than what we see nationally. There have been studies by the American Journalism Review just tracking the number of reporters who cover state government. And over the last 15 years, there's been a precipitous drop in those numbers. So there's a lot less accountability in terms of the big spending that takes place in individual states.
We're talking to Darrell West of the Brookings Institution about his new book, Billionaires. You can join the conversation. Are you worried about the influence of the very wealthiest in Wisconsin or around the world? Or have they earned that extra influence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Darrell West, talking about the influence and power of the wealthiest of the wealthy. His new book is called Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the wealthiest citizens of the U.S. have too much influence or no? Do you think laws need to change to limit that influence, or does that infringe on free speech and free association rights? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Darrell, you talk about some solutions in your book, ways to reduce the power of billionaires, the influence they have on American politics. One of the things you say is to fix our governance, and you start with the Senate.
The Senate is a key place for this get a senator strategy just because of its rules that allow secret holds to block nominations and the use of the filibuster to stop legislation. And so if we're serious about kind of looking at the governance aspects of these wealth inequalities that I'm talking about, we need to eliminate the secret holds on appointments. I mean, senators should at least be accountable. Like, if they want to block a nomination, they should be forced to go public with that and explain why they think someone is not qualified for a particular office. Also, I believe we need filibuster reform because right now, one individual can basically stop the entire chamber from taking action. So I think those are some ideas that would help make a difference in this area.
And you're hoping to see more transparency in the way political contributions happen.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the biggest problems. It's not just the big spending that we're seeing, but the fact that often we don't know who is behind that money. And so we have lost transparency. Like, if you go back 20 years, we actually had much greater transparency in terms of campaign finance. But because of the recent Supreme Court decisions, they've blown gaping holes in our campaign finance rules. And so it's much easier for rich people to spend large amounts of money trying to influence the process.
We'll go to your calls now for Darrell West, author of the new book, Billionaires, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Daniel in Minong. Daniel, hi.
Hello. Hello. Wisconsin Governor Walker received large contributions from the Koch brothers, who are multi-billionaires. Are billionaires buying governors and grooming them for presidential candidacy? Are billionaires buying the presidency?
Daniel, thanks for the call. Daryl?
Well, they certainly tried in 2012 and failed, but it doesn't mean they won't be successful in the future. Certainly, the Koch brothers are the poster boys of billionaire political activism. Between the two of them, Charles and David, they control about $100 billion in assets. In this year's Senate races, it's estimated they're going to spend over $290 million, which, you know, to all of us sounds like a lot of money, but if you have $100 billion, you know, it's kind of pocket change for them.
And you mentioned that last political campaign in the Republican primary. Newt Gingrich was riding high, and a lot of his campaign drew from the support of one billionaire.
Absolutely. Sheldon Adelson, who owns casinos in Las Vegas and elsewhere, was Gingrich's big funder. And so, you know, after it became clear that Gingrich was not doing well, he was losing primaries, like typically in that situation, the candidate is forced to drop out of the race. But if you have a billionaire at your side who's willing to put a lot of money into your campaign, you can basically stick around as long as you want and as long as that billionaire will keep funding you. So it is starting to alter the nature of the nominating process. Sheldon Adelson a few months ago held a gathering in Las Vegas that came to be known as the Sheldon primary. You had a bunch of Republican contenders basically go to this conference in hopes of developing their relationship with him, knowing that he's going to be a very crucial player in the 2016 presidential process.
And as with the candidates you mentioned, political causes, especially at the state level, are very dependent on, in some ways, the quirks and whims of billionaires. Can a billionaire really put an agenda item on the map in a state or even at the national level?
Absolutely. In fact, I think it's at the state level where billionaires have achieved their greatest successes and where they have some of their strongest influence. Because, you know, if you have a mid-sized state like Wisconsin, someone can come in and spend $2.5 million or $5 million, and that's a big deal for a Wisconsin election. I mean, you can buy a lot of money buy a lot of influence for that. You know, in a large state like New York or California, $2.5 million wouldn't be so much. And so billionaires have discovered that between the fact that their money goes a long way in smaller states and the fact that the news media often don't have the same capacity to report on what's going on, as was the case 10 years ago, that you can end up with a one-sided campaign. Now, sometimes this benefits conservative causes. Other times it can benefit liberal causes. But it certainly is an example kind of showing the power of big money.
Moving back to your solutions ideas, you mentioned news coverage just now. You'd like to see a change in journalism and the way issues and these billionaires are covered.
Well, we need to have more coverage of what is going on. Now, it's harder today because of all of the secrecy, because billionaires have discovered that they can be influential through direct campaign contributions, but they also have formed nonprofit organizations. So a lot of individuals, both on the left and the right, now have nonprofit organizations with which they work. They often don't have to report contributions to these groups, and so it's hard to kind of figure out what's going on. And so we need better news coverage, but it's actually a big problem getting the information that would allow reporters to report on these types of activities.
So you mentioned concentrations of wealth comparable to, what, 90 years ago or so. Does the influence of the very wealthiest in this country ebb and flow, or is it just flowing higher and higher for the foreseeable future?
It does ebb and flow. Like, a lot of people basically have said, hey, you know, every society has rich people. The United States always has had rich people. And certainly, you know, we remember the Rockefellers and the Carnegies. But when you look at patterns of income concentration during the 20th century and now into the 21st century, we see the high point of income concentration was in the 1920s. And then it dropped down considerably in the post-World War II period. But then basically starting about 1980 and for the last 30 years, it's actually risen back so that the current level of wealth concentration is as unequal as it was during the 1920s.
All right, Daryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Daryl West of the Brookings Institution. We've been talking about his new book, It's Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and we'll learn how to bake with honey. But first, this morning's opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange rang in what may become the biggest initial public offering, or IPO, in U.S. history. The Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba's U.S. stock offering opened this morning at $98 a share. That's 38% higher than its original expected price. The company is expected to raise at least $21 billion in this offering, knocking Visa out of the top spot as the biggest U.S. IPO ever. Well, it raises some fundamental questions like who, what, and is this going to affect us down the road? With us now is Chris Farrell. He's economics editor at Marketplace Money and economics correspondent for Marketplace. He's also a contributing economics editor at Business Week magazine. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Well, first, who and what is Alibaba?
So Alibaba is the founder. He founded 15 years ago out of an apartment in China. Is an internet company that creates marketplaces. So it matches buyers and sellers. And the total transactions over its websites last year was, what, $250 billion. Just to put that in context, for Amazon, it's about $116 billion.
Wow. And so this company, as I understand it, is a little bit Amazon, a little bit eBay, and a whole lot of other stuff, too.
Yes, it is. And I think eBay is the right analogy because what eBay does is eBay is an auction market, but it's matching buyers and sellers. That's a lot what Alibaba does because its profit margins, I mean, this is kind of pretty amazing. Its profit margin is about 40%. So it doesn't actually, you know, own the stuff that it's selling, competing in the retail business. It's bringing together the buyers and the sellers and taking a piece of the action. So this reflects the power of the consumer in China and the rise of the consumer in China. And it's also a good business model that I think we're going to be seeing some competition here in the U.S.
And the founder of the company, as you said, he started it in his apartment. He's a former English teacher. He rang the bell on Wall Street. This has been all over the news. Why are we so excited about this initial offering here?
You know, I think this is one of those bright letter days in history that will stand out for a long period of time. So if we're thinking about the digital universe, the digital economy, do you remember it was back in 1995 in August, Netscape. Remember Netscape?
Oh, yeah.
It went public, and the stock went way up. And the thing is, you know, what that signaled, and that was really the beginning of the dot-com boom, what it signaled to corporate America was that there were enormous commercial possibilities in the internet. And it also signaled to every entrepreneur out there that was in the high-tech world that this is where we're going to put our money, this is where we're going to put our brain power. Now you look at what Alibaba has done. It's created enormous wealth in China. It's got 6,000 employees and shareholders. They've got a lot of wealth. And I think this really signals that the entrepreneurial high-tech sector of China is growing rapidly. It has been growing rapidly. It's like a public statement that they're on the world stage. And therefore, this digital economy is going to grow a lot faster from a global perspective. It's going to grow a lot faster. It's going to be a lot deeper and a lot more competitive than it was pre-IPO.
Yeah, you know, you hear the story, they started in a garage or the back room or whatever, and they ended up being billionaires. You could attach a lot of American names to that high-tech story. Are we going to see more and more Chinese names having that story told?
We absolutely are. And the city of Huangshe, which is where Alibaba is based and where it was founded, it's becoming an entrepreneurial hotspot. And there's a university there that is kind of a feeder into all this high-tech entrepreneurialism. And then you have a number of other Chinese companies, you know, that are laying down the gauntlet that, you know, they're going to be going after some of the markets that Cisco's in and that IBM is in. And so I do think this signals the beginning of a new stage of increased competition, sophisticated competition in the high-tech sector, and much more global. And Silicon Valley will remain important, but Silicon Valley over the next 10 years will probably not be as important as it was as their other parts of the economy become like it.
Now, most of us aren't probably buying Alibaba stock today, but is there going to be a time not far down the road when instead of going to Amazon to buy something or to a brick-and-mortar store or their website or eBay, we're going to be doing something that Alibaba at least partly owns in the U.S.?
I sure hope so. And that seems to be the plan. I mean, that was part of what the money that they're raising with this IPO, initial public offering. And yes, they're very interested in expanding into the U.S. and is going to increase their options. And I think it's really going to provide, if they do move more into the U.S., you know, provide some real options for small entrepreneurs to have a really viable digital presence. They're very strong in Brazil, for example. They have a very big presence in South America. They're coming here, and Amazon's going to have increased competition.
Now, among the many wacky things that makes the economy hard to understand, we've been hearing in the news that
there are quite a few of those.
There's a lot of them. We're hearing Yahoo is making a lot of money because they own a lot of the stock. I know Alibaba, I guess, owns some or all of companies like Lyft, so some things that are more familiar names in the U.S. It's hard to know, just watching from the outside, where one company begins and the other ends, even when we're talking about American and Chinese companies.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that, you know, that really is the story of companies and globalization. Because if you go and you buy a Honda car, you know, most of it is made. In fact, we are now exporting from the Honda plant in Ohio, we're exporting to the rest of the world Honda cars. And if you look at that Honda car and you look underneath the hood, the Honda car is largely made in America, but it's also got parts coming from Germany and parts coming from Japan. I mean, it's a global product, even though it has this label Honda. And you've hit on, I think, a really important thing. I think, you know, people are buying pieces of each other. It's all kind of mixed in together. And, you know, Alibaba has its own payment system, Alipay, just like you know, eBay has PayPal. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a lot of what is going on, except for what we do know is that as consumers, I think the consumer is a true beneficiary. There, that this will provide more options and more prospects for some cheaper prices. And from the entrepreneurial point of view, again, I think this just adds to the entrepreneurial prospects from a global perspective.
Okay. You point toward a positive benefit for consumers, more competition going to drive down prices for us maybe in the short run, or is this going to be an even bigger fish that drives out the large fish, and ultimately the markets are going to get more concentrated and we're going to have fewer options on buying stuff?
Well, you know, there is in the high-tech markets, there's the sort of first mover advantage and the network advantage. So if you look at a company like Alibaba, which has grown to be this enormous presence, there have been other internet-based companies in China, but they've gotten so big that now everyone turns to them. And so you do see that effect. And it definitely is something that goes on in the high-tech world. I think you've hit on something extremely important. It's farther down the line. However, it's something that we really do have to keep a close eye on, that even though there are lots of names out there, how much beneath the surface is there consolidation going on, and is there a little bit of monopoly pricing power going on? But I think over the next, 10 years, that's probably not going to be the story, but that is something to really keep an eye on.
I'm going to end with kind of an old-fashioned concept of a national economy. We used to be big manufacturers. We had, a lot of tough competition from China and elsewhere. Information, for a long time, has been our distinctive product here in the United States. Now, there's this big Chinese technology company that's taking that over. Is there anything that we do here in the U.S. that still has a competitive advantage that someone else can't duplicate and do better?
I don't think you can. Once you add in can't duplicate and do better, I don't think so. I think that there's no reason. There's nothing in our DNA here that says that we are going to do it better than other people. What we do have is an edge that we are still open to entrepreneurship. And we are open, we are more open than many societies to allowing for innovation and then figure out how to deal with it later on with the downside. So that is a real strength. And we have an incredible education system, and we have a pretty good feeder system between innovative companies and the education system. But from a global perspective, if we don't improve our overall education system, and if we don't raise the incomes of the bottom half of society, we can no longer rely on just say, well, we're the most innovative, we're the most creative, we'll come up with the new ideas, let other people make it. That no longer is going to work. You're going to have to be your human capital investments have got to pay off throughout an economy, not just a 10%.
Chris, you always make economics fun and comprehensible. Thank you for joining us again.
Thanks a lot.
That's Chris Farrell. He's Marketplace Money's economics editor, also a contributing economics editor at Business Week magazine. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Late summer and early fall, as I understand it, are prime honey harvesting times. There's a lot of local product hitting the stores. So it's a good time to talk about cooking and baking with honey. One of WPR's in-house foodies, Lori Skelton, has been experimenting, as always, this time with honey in the kitchen over the last few weeks, and she's here to share what she's learned. Lori, welcome back.
It's good to be here, especially about this topic.
Yeah, so I am always surprised at how much variety there is in the world of honey. I just think honey is a thing like white sugar or something. I am so very wrong.
Which is why I hit the Dane County Farmers Market a couple of weeks ago. I went to three different vendors and bought a jar of what they called wildflower honey.
Mm-hmm.
No difference, no specific flower, just wildflower honey. But it came from three different parts of the state. So just having everybody tasting the honey was three different tastes altogether.
And so what kind of varieties did you find and the rest of our coworkers when they tried these three different wildflower honeys from Wisconsin?
Well, to start off with, closest to Madison is Marsden's in McFarland, which everybody said classic honey taste. Very sweet, had a butterscotch caramel note to it. This is what I associate honey with. You recognize Dale Marsden when you're on the square in Madison. He's the guy who's wearing the hat that looks like a beehive.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you go to Gentle Breeze in Mount Horeb, and they don't always have wildflower honey. Mm-hmm. When they do, you'll definitely notice it. It's one of the darkest honeys around. This is the one that everybody said reminded them of molasses, of ginger snaps.
Wow.
Somebody said this tasted almost like bourbon. And then from Boscobel, there was from San Cortez and Herbs, they do their wildflower honey with a little bit of the comb still in it, so there was some texture to it. Almost everybody talked about how flowery this one tasted. This one had even more of the outside in the jar than just sweetness. This was really surprising to a lot of people.
So it just depends on what flora is available in the wildflower community for these local bees to get at.
I of course, was asking, when you say wildflower, are you talking native plants or are you just talking what happens to be in somebody's back garden? And there's a wide range. I have neighbors on my street who have hives. Mm-hmm. And they actually harvested a little bit of honey in early June. Pale golden color, delicate flavor. And then the honey they were harvesting 2 weeks ago, I mean, if it's based on the 30 flowers I had in my backyard to begin with, we're talking a real hodgepodge here.
All right. Well, I missed a lot of the honey tasting, but you brought one in to try today, and I'm going to give this a shot now.
Now, this isn't local.
It's not local. Oh, this is Italian.
This comes from Tuscany.
Okay.
One of the first times I ever tried cooking with honey in a savory recipe was something that was recommended for Tuscan fennel, and that is chestnut honey from Tuscany. I love this stuff. And if you've got an Italian grocery in your neighborhood, there's a good bet you'll be able to find this. If not, it's easy to order online.
All right, I'm taken aback by what I'm tasting. I mean, it's honey. Yeah.
But
there's a lot going on. So, I mean, like, there's so much variety. I mean, people get all, you know, wine expert on it. There's so much variety. Like, is there that level of difference and variation?
Absolutely. And as you're spending more and more time local, sustainable, and more people are starting to look into having hives of their own, it can be as fun as having a craft beer party if everybody shows up with their own jar of honey.
Wow. So honey is sweet.
Honey is
sweet. Newsflash, people. But you mentioned using it in savory dishes. What kind of savory dishes would we put honey in?
Everybody thinks of honey glazed carrots, but it's great on other vegetables as well. Fennel is a great one to start with. If you are a little bit unsure about using fennel, mm-hmm. braise it with honey, and it's going to make a real difference to whatever protein you're serving it with. An easy way to get started is to take your protein and just use honey as the glaze to give it some moisture and sweetness. It's marvelous with salmon. It's marvelous with duck. And when I put out the call for give me some suggestions, a friend of mine says she does a version of meatballs that she discovered on the Ivory Coast, where she's got her ground meat mixed with red pepper flakes, garlic, peanuts, carrots, thyme, mint, marjoram, and then when the meatballs come out of the oven, she drizzles them with honey and lemon juice and serves it over rice.
Well, that sounds amazing. And I guess if I think about it, a lot of barbecue sauces have honey in them, so it's not as crazy as I thought it sounded.
Absolutely.
At first.
Oddly enough, one of the interesting things about a sweeter meat like duck or rabbit or a nice hefty salmon, it can sometimes play with additional sweetness without going overboard. And for something like that, this more savory honey, this chestnut honey that has that almost menthol aftertaste, buckwheat is another good one that is a little bit better for savory dishes. You can have a lot of fun experimenting.
And then getting away from the savories, you made some treats to try at WPR, some honey cakes. And by the way, we've got a recipe or two on the Central Time Facebook page. You made a loaf, a honey cake loaf.
Honey cakes are a traditional food served for Rosh Hashanah, which is next week. And I was checking with a lot of friends. Tell me about honey cake, your favorite. Almost everyone said, you know, it's traditional, but they usually turn out dry. They're not always the most pleasant to eat. So my focus was on finding recipes that wouldn't be dry. For the loaf version, I used a solid cup of that molasses-type honey, along with a little bit of spice, and you make it a couple of days ahead of time. Honey has this wonderful property in that it's hygroscopic. It pulls moisture from the air. So if you make it ahead a couple of days, it'll actually get a little less dry.
Weird.
And it was delicious. The texture was moist enough, but it wasn't heavy, but it still had a robustness. Again, I almost want to say it was rustic, especially when you contrast it to what I was absolutely shocked to find from a bunch of Australian Jewish cooks, a chiffon cake made with honey.
All right, tell us about that chiffon cake, yeah.
Now, one of the things you have to watch when you're baking with honey, especially if a recipe doesn't normally call for all of its sweetness, honey is acidic. So you have to add a little bit extra baking soda. You have to do something to leaven it. And this one, it actually called for self-rising flour, and it was half honey and half sugar. But oddly enough, you didn't taste any sugar. This cake, before it was glazed, had the lightest, almost a spongy texture to it, and the honey flavor just lingered in your mouth long after you took a bite. They suggested glazing it with lemon and confectioner's sugar. I actually preferred it without the glaze.
You know, it's interesting talking about baking with honey where the recipe doesn't call for it. I've had things where I think people just substituted honey for sugar, and it was not good.
When you're dealing with a really, really sweet honey, something that doesn't have a lot of complexity to it, it's maybe one specific note, you may want to dial back. Normally, you can substitute honey for sugar up to a cup. Once you get to a cup or more, you'll definitely want to dial it back, probably reduce it by 1/4 cup for every cup of sugar you would normally use. Honey does caramelize faster, so you might also want to turn your oven down about 25 degrees if your recipe doesn't originally call for honey.
And we mentioned a Rosh Hashanah and the traditional honey cake. Is honey a staple ingredient, you know, in Jewish cooking?
Well, when you consider where a lot of Jewish cultures began, especially around the Mediterranean, you know, think about Greek cuisine and Turkish and North African. Wherever you're not going to find cane sugar, you're going to find honey. And there's another Rosh Hashanah tradition. In addition to the honey cake, it's dipping apples in honey to wish for a sweet new year. Oddly enough, honey will do for cut apples and pears the same thing that lemon juice will do. It will prevent them from browning.
Because it's acidic, like you said.
And so if you want to make a fruit salad that holds its color, but you don't want to have the lemon or the lime flavor, go ahead and make a very weak honey water, and that should do it.
Well, that's brilliant. What a great tip to leave us with. Lori, thanks, as always, for joining us.
This was sweet. Lashana Tova.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies. And again, you can find the honey cake recipes over at the Central Time Facebook page. Make them. Bring them to Vilas Hall. You'll probably want to eat them yourselves. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.